From the New York Times, I'm Michael Barbaro. This is The Daily. Today, the president issues a new ban on travel from predominantly Muslim countries. Has the policy changed or just the message? And a slow-paced television drama about a bygone era in Russian-American relations now takes on an entirely new relevance. It's Tuesday, March 7th.
Well, good morning, and thank you for joining us. The executive order signed by the president earlier today, protecting the nation from foreign terrorist entry into the United States, is a vital measure for strengthening our national security.
On Monday, inside a conference room in downtown Washington, a few blocks from the White House, members of the president's cabinet announced an executive order reissuing the temporary ban on immigration from Muslim-majority nations.
And with this order, President Trump is exercising his rightful authority to keep our people safe.
It was, in many ways, a do-over.
I'm establishing new vetting measures to keep radical Islamic terrorists out of the United States of America. We don't want them here.
Actually, a pretty sizable protest here at JFK. As you can see, several hundreds of people.
The president's first travel ban, which barred entry from seven countries, led to protest, confusion, and outrage.
We will not turn away children.
We will not turn away children.
We will not turn away families.
We will not turn away families.
Before ultimately, a court found the order unconstitutional.
As threats to our security continue to evolve and change,
Monday's travel ban was different.
Common sense dictates that we continually reevaluate and reassess the systems we rely upon to protect our country.
Different in both presentation.
While no system can be made completely infallible, the American people can have high confidence. We are identifying ways to improve the vetting process and thus keep terrorists from entering our country.
And different in substance. Unlike the original, the new order will not block foreigners traveling with valid green cards or visas. It will not favor admitting Christian refugees over Muslims. And it will not bar travelers from seven countries, only six.
I think the biggest difference, of course, is that Iraq has been left out.
I spoke with Nick Kulish, who has spent weeks reporting on the travel ban, and Maggie Haberman, a White House reporter.
It caused a whole lot of problems trying to take a U.S. ally with whom we're currently fighting a war against ISIS to not allow various people from that country to travel here for diplomatic, military reasons. I think the other biggest difference is just that it's a slow implementation. It's a slow phase in rather than the sudden door slamming shut in the way that caused such chaos and left so many people in limbo and in detention at airports around the country and around the world last time.
You know, the White House is trying to say that this is basically the same. This is no retreat. And, you know, the lack of retreat is very important to the president. In fact, there are so many concessions and carve-outs in this one that you would have Democrats claiming a massive victory were they not so afraid of their own base getting upset if it looked like they were doing any praise of the administration. But it's sort of fascinating. I mean, there are a lot of concessions in this new version. It is basically doing everything to answer what courts had complained about. And I still think we will probably see a court challenge just based on history. But it is substantially different. And on the Iraq piece, it is, yes, in terms of an ally on fighting terror, you had the White House claim privately that the change was made in terms of Iraq because the Iraqi government had made the case to Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, that they had a systemic operation in place for vetting people.
Had they gotten better?
And that they had gotten better. And while portions of that might be true, we have also heard that actually it was primarily the concern around alienating an ally.
I want to express my appreciation to Prime Minister al-Abadi of Iraq for his positive engagement and support for implementing these actions.
And I don't want to dwell too much on that, but what that suggests is that this may not foremostly be just about security. There may be questions of diplomacy and strategic partnership involved in which states are going to be on this travel ban.
It's pretty striking when you think about the fact that Saudi Arabia isn't on the ban, Pakistan isn't included, Afghanistan isn't included, and now one of the two countries that the Islamic State is is based in Iraq also isn't in there. So the question of kind of exactly which Islamist terrorists the administration believes that it's targeting is a real question. And it's starting to look more like countries like Libya and Somalia that are sort of easy to keep out, or Yemen, rather than the countries where we're most worried about a threat.
A question for both of you. What is still the same? What was carried over from the original travel ban and exists still in the new one?
Large groups of people from these predominantly Muslim countries won't be able to come to the United States. I think particularly when you look at Iran, there's a huge Iranian-American community, many of whom have been here for decades. And people travel to and from the United States from Iran to visit family, for weddings, for funerals, to study. That's going to really affect that community. The Somali community in Minnesota, you know, again, the same. For those of us living here in New York City, are, you know, Yemeni bodega owners. So for a lot of people, this is still going to really restrict their movement, their access to the United States.
Let's talk for just a minute about refugees. The new travel ban stops all refugees from entering the U.S. for 90 days. But when that ends, refugees are going to run up against this separate issue, which is a cap on refugees. So between the two of those measures, Nick, how hard is it going to be for a refugee to enter the United States from now on?
I mean, my understanding is that we're getting pretty close to this 50,000 cap for the year, after which presumably refugees simply won't be able to get in. Under President Obama, the cap for refugees admitted to the United States each year was 110,000. And President Trump has already lowered that to 50,000. So it's less than half of what it used to be, which is a pretty significant reduction, and means that probably in just a month or two we'll have already reached it.
When the president talks about why it's so important to keep certain people out of the U.S. right now, he almost always points to Europe.
You look at Sweden the other night. Did you see what happened in Sweden the other night?
France is no longer France.
You got millions of people going into Germany and other countries in Europe right now.
And says that their open borders allow for attacks by Islamic terrorists.
All over Europe, it's happening.
Is there truth to that threat?
I think it's important to recognize that there have been some pretty devastating attacks. When I think of the Paris attack,
Associated Press reporting there have been two suicide attacks and one bombing outside a soccer stadium. There have also been shootings, and a large number of people have been taken hostage.
So the Brussels attacks.
A series of deadly bombs, at least one packed with nails, killing dozens, injuring hundreds.
I think it's also important to remember that anyone responsible for border security really does wake up in the middle of the night having had nightmares that they let the person in who committed the attack. I've talked to these people, and this is a real fear for them. And if you're responsible for this nation's security, you take it very, very seriously. But the evidence statistically is that the people from these countries have not been committing deadly terrorist attacks in the United States for the most part.
The original seven and now the final six.
Exactly.
The White House worked closely with the Department of Homeland Security, the Department of Justice, and the Department of State to create an order that addresses previous concerns and protects the homeland and every one of our citizens.
Let's turn to the changes in presentation, Maggie. Describe the scene for us in the Reagan Building in downtown Washington when this new plan was announced.
It's a little bit of a different scene than what we saw last time, which was just a montage really primarily with the president.
Right. And this time, it was Secretary of State Rex Tillerson.
This revised order will bolster the security of the United States and her allies.
It was Attorney General Jeff Sessions.
The Department of Justice believes that this executive order is a lawful and proper exercise of presidential authority.
And Secretary of Homeland Security John Kelly.
The fact remains that we are not immune to terrorist threats and that our enemies often use our own freedoms in generosity against us.
But no Trump. Why wasn't the president there to explain this major new executive order?
Well, he has an amazing ability to compartmentalize, to some extent anyway, on certain things. The first was this massive success, according to him, despite what the courts said and despite what our own eyes told us on all of these images at airports. To go and re-sign it again would be giving his critics something in his mind. And so it is much easier to make this seem like some administrative detail that had to be tended to by cabinet secretaries as opposed to something that the president would do personally.
And part of what really strikes me is when the initial ban came down and you had people literally trapped in airports, and then you have citizens outside protesting something to try to free them. You have a big scene, you have a big stink, and you have a problem that you need to deal with. And it, I think it also probably helps catch the attention of the courts and so on. But, you know, if done a little more carefully and handled a little more slowly and people aren't out with their placards at JFK and LAX, you know, maybe you can slowly start restricting travel from these countries in a more permanent way.
Nicholas, Maggie, thank you very much for coming on A Busy Day.
Thanks for having us.
We'll be right back.
What if she sends the tape?
We might have to leave.
You and Dad?
All of us.
Where? Wait. Are you serious?
When The Americans debuted in 2013, it evoked a distant era in American life, when the Soviet Union sought to inflict damage on the United States and our democratic system.
Philip and Elizabeth Jennings, posing as suburban travel agents in Virginia, are actually Soviet spies.
James Poniewozik is the chief television critic at The Times and an admirer of the show.
Whose marriage was arranged by the KGB and were moved to the United States of America, where they established a cover, bought a house, raised two children, and don a variety of fantastic wigs and undergo various covert operations to gain intelligence, etc., for Mother Russia.
As the fifth season of The Americans begins tonight, the collapse of the Soviet Union looms over the fictional story of Philip and Elizabeth. But outside the world of the show, a new and very real era in the U.S. relationship to Russia is just beginning. And that means we'll see the show much differently than we did before.
You were watching a story about a chapter in American history that we felt was over, and also an element that allowed you to engage with the story of basically America's enemies, because you knew that the Soviet Union was going to lose the Cold War.
They were defanged.
The wall was going to fall, you know, communism would fail, et cetera, et cetera. So you're watching these characters who are essentially fighting a doomed mission. When you open the newspaper now, necessarily the way you receive the story kind of changes.
Let's talk about some of the more obvious parallels between what's going on in The Americans and what's happening right now.
One element that it has been in place in The Americans for a while is the sort of nebulous gray area between diplomacy and espionage. There's a whole storyline that involves the Residentura, which is the basically KGB office within the Soviet embassy in Washington that, you know, undertakes official activities and less official activities, that, you know, does legitimate diplomatic work and liaises with spies. And so there is a sort of, you know, fuzzing there of the boundaries between the legitimate and illegitimate presence of the Soviet state in the United States. You know, in the same way that that sounds familiar to, although not exactly like, this whole question of who has the Russian ambassador had conversations
and
with and when and what were they talking about and who was being offered what. So certainly that idea of fuzzing the boundary between diplomacy and espionage is a very familiar thing.
If we use the Americans and the Cold War as a starting point and we land it today, how much has spycraft evolved from the 1980s Russia to 2017 Russia?
I should preface this by saying that I'm basing my knowledge on the fictionalized presentation of espionage that's presented in The Americans.
Of course, because you are a TV critic and not a national security reporter.
Of course, that's just what a covert spy would want you to believe. But yes, there is a kind of sort of old school analog quaintness, you know, to what you see in the Americans, a sort of pre-digital version of spying. You stage elaborate long con operations and, you know, you get entree into the office of the FBI by having a sham marriage with a secretary.
Oh, no. No, I didn't agree to this. I don't want this. What have you done? What have I done?
It's a different form. It's immersive, you know, in a way that involves sort of burying yourself essentially in a role as opposed to cracking information and then deciding how that can best be put to use.
Another big difference is that the lines between the Soviet Union and the United States are far more clearly drawn in this show. Back then, it was more about spies versus spies, agents of the Soviet Union against agents of the U.S. government. Now it feels like those lines are much blurrier.
Well, I mean, and again, that's another thing that seems almost quaint and reassuring about the Americans now. You know, then,
let us be aware that while they preach the supremacy of the state,
Ronald Reagan said that the Soviet Union was the evil empire.
They are the focus of evil in the modern world.
Now, there's this whole question of, well, who on our side is, you know, the enemy of Russia? Who is a friend? I mean, Russia has for a while occupied this sort of nebulous frenemy status with the United States to begin with. But, you know, now you have questions of, well, you know, were they involved with the campaign? Do they have influence in the government that is in power now? It's a much, much bigger game than anything that is going on in the Americans, which is supposed to be the Hollywood fantasy version of spying.
In my TV watching adulthood years, a couple of shows, I think of Homeland, which you mentioned, but also 24, have found ways to really capitalize on their relevancy in the moment. They seem to really inhabit America's deepest anxieties about terrorism and external threats. Is the Americans going to do that? And can it even possibly do that, given what's happening with the U.S. and Russia right now?
I mean, I think it certainly could. You know, I don't know that the final season of The Americans is going to involve, you know, a time jump to 2016, although I wouldn't put anything past it. But, you know, I think that there's certainly a lot that you can do to play up the parallels. I think there are just, you know, thematic things that you can play into, which is one kind of distinguishing feature of espionage and just, you know, the news today is this notion of not being quite sure what is real. Disinformation. And I think that a show that's basically based on a lie, people who have created an entire fictitious story for themselves, you know, probably has a lot of room to, you know, play with its storyline in ways that maybe are still set in the Cold War, but feel very 2017.
Fake news.
Fake news.
It feels very nostalgic for some viewers, and I count myself among them, to watch a show that glamorizes a part of history, even a war in our history, now that it's completely over. And I guess the big question with the Americans is, can you glamorize a relevant, ongoing conflict in the same way?
You know, one analogy I would say to the Americans that I think of, even though it was a comedy, is MASH, you know? MASH was a comedy about the Korean War, right? Except it was really about Vietnam.
It was war as hell. Remember, you heard it here last.
War isn't hell. War is war and hell is hell. And of the two, war is a lot worse.
And, you know, you didn't need a decoder ring to figure out the, you know, the parallels and the commentary that was going on.
There are no innocent bystanders in hell. But war is chock full of them. Little kids, cripples, old ladies. In fact, except for a few of the brass, almost everybody involved is an innocent bystander.
So while I'm not sure that you could necessarily sell a story about a lovable pair of spies, you know, seeking to infiltrate the Trump campaign in 2016, that might be a bit too soon. You can certainly turn, you know, sort of like MASH did, a story of the last war into a story of this war.
James, thank you very much.
Yeah, thank you.
Here's what else you need to know today. House Republicans have unveiled their long-awaited plan to repeal and replace the Affordable Care Act. the plan would replace the mandate that Americans have insurance with a system of tax credits aimed at encouraging them to buy it on the free market. And the Times is reporting that President Trump, worried about political fallout from Republican efforts to defund Planned Parenthood, privately offered to preserve the group's federal funding if it stopped performing abortions. Planned Parenthood has declined the offer. Finally, the Supreme Court will not rule on a major case involving transgender rights, as it had planned to, after the Trump administration reversed a federal government position that public school students be allowed to use the bathroom of their choice. That's it for The Daily. I'm Michael Barbaro. See you tomorrow.